God. All right, then.
Alright. Oh, we're at CitiCon. I've just finished my...
CitiCon.
Son of a bitch. Strode's track over.
Yeah.
We're at Genericon. It's awful. Just freaking awful. Shut that bloody bazooki up. I'll be thinking of that next. So we're at Genericon 2011, and I just finished my Unusual Manga Genres panel, which seemed to go over pretty well. I don't think... It seemed like those people hadn't heard of Legend of Koizumi. I'm not even, like, looking at my levels, but they're alright. Sony says to put it in the middle.
Right.
I'm recording this on a Marantz kit, which I borrowed from work. Unfortunately, I left it on pause through most of the panel recording, which you...
Not have. My fault.
It was not Noah's fault. Hopefully, we'll talk to some other podcasters and get more content. We also recorded the Italia history panel by a one Walter Emus, which was excellent. I didn't record the sound clips from the show because... I don't know. I think just listening to the Japanese audio wouldn't really get the point across anyway. Now we're kind of walking through this strange outdoor passageway. Because it's a Marantz kit, I can just keep going. Like, whatever. It doesn't pick up any noise. Maybe that's why. Apparently Geek Nights had one and they were bragging about it. I don't know if you heard that earlier. Bragging about their awesome Marantz. Oh, that's a good point. They're not used most of the semester? Apparently I have to get approval from my boss's boss, so... I could probably not rent out all nine at the same time. I don't think I could get approval for that many. You're like a sniper gun. First aid sniper. Medic?
Yeah.
She's firing at us. Well, it's medicine, though, so it's okay. That's my understanding. Now we're heading to Con Ops. Ooh, it's decimated. There's no one here.
Well, that's because, I mean, there is a VIP room. That's where we were, right?
Sure, but this room has been crowded before, too. Maybe it was just everyone's dinner. Oh, here's some people. Oh, there's coffee. I don't know if those people who were sleeping in the corner earlier were Japanese guests or what. Are there Japanese guests at this con? Huh. Alright, I'll stop this recording.
Stop it! It's fucking awful! Ah! Torture!
Vocaloid programs. You can program it to do the voices. If you have fans of my age, you may remember Megazone 23 and Eve Token Matsuri, or in some generation, Sharon Apple in MacOS. We have those now. And they're rapping about the question of greater versus lesser Germany, which was a real question at the time. Should we have all the German-speaking peoples united under one big empire, which probably the dominant power in that would then be the Austro-Hungarian Empire, so it would be ruled from Vienna, or have the solution that Otto Bismarck wanted, which is have, you know, Austria also has almost the ethnic peoples, the Hungarians and the Catholic Magyars, and we can keep them, we don't want them. I just want the northern German states, Prussia and Bavaria and the rest, to be unified into what we end up as Germany, and in that case it would be dominated by Prussia and ruled from Berlin, which is of course what Bismarck was at. And this was a big question at the time. A question that most Americans have never heard of and don't give a crap about, but nevertheless, here's this goofy guy, this video going on about it. So, like I said, my brain leaps out my YouTube pendant. Then I start looking at the comments on this. There are obviously comments from, high school kids. Like, oh, this helped me on my history test, blah, blah, blah. And what is this show? And people say, oh, this show is APH. A lot of the comments always say that, but APH. So I start Googling, what is APH? And if you Google for APH, well, you will find that things like, associated plumbing and heating or something like that. It took a while for me to find out what the actual damn show was. And then later that afternoon, this was a Saturday, I had a friend at the time, this fellow Ken is an artist, who taught a class I live in Rahway, New Jersey, there's an art center there. I taught a Saturday afternoon class on how to draw comics. Most of the kids in it are high school age and anime manga fans, and how to draw the manga style. And he came over and said, Ken, you wouldn't believe this, there's this anime YouTube video rapping about the Austro-Prussian War and Greater versus Lesser Germany and blah, blah, blah. He goes, oh yeah, that's the show X Cars are telling. All the kids in my class are totally apeshit over it. They're all cosplaying as it. They're going to all conventions. There's one girl who's absolutely obsessed over Prussia all the time, blah, blah. And in fact, in the subsequent conversation, he said, this girl who's obsessed over Prussia was so going on about all the time. Somebody else in the class asked, well, what's so great about Prussia? You know, what's going on about? So now most Americans, most Americans don't even know that Prussia was a country. And if they know Prussia was a country at all, the only thing they know about is, Otto von Bismarck, Einstein, militarism, build an empire, and then have a world war, and lose the whole freaking empire. What's special about Prussia? No. What this girl came out and said, what Ken told me was, did you know that Prussia was the first country in Europe to have guaranteed old age pensions, and mandatory worker vacations, and health care, and all about the German social welfare, which all was true. And had me grinning from ear to ear, because I've probably explained this to people many times, and wow! So I said, I have to find out what the show is, and so it got me interested, it got me showing it to my friend Rob, my co-author, who is the serious historian, actually did teach history in New Jersey for a while, and thus we got started. So, in reference to the war just cited above, let me give you a little bit of background on that war. From some of the actors in the series, I have the DVD it's set sitting here, The Bald Eagles, a wonderful show which I highly recommend to you, a British live-action drama from the 70s about the houses of Habsburg, Hohenzollern, and Romanov from 1848 to the end of the First World War, and supplies about 20% of the video in this panel. So here is Otto von Bismarck and Helmut von Moltke, one of the greatest military commanders of all time. Moltke came up with the concept of the general staff, the idea that we're going to train all our officers together so they all know how we think. And so when we're fighting a battle, off in the battlefield, we're all running around doing different stuff, and we know that the objective is to take that hill. I don't have to go and send a rider back to the field march and say, oh, situation over here, having a problem, should I push my troops this way or that way or whatever. And this is a problem, how you organize armies in the days before telecommunication, is that the rider to go back to get orders would get lost or get shot or something, and the orders would never come back, or they'd come back hours later, the situation would change. It was a real pain to coordinate the battle. Moltke had the idea, no, we'll all train armies together, know how we think, and on the battlefield, you are free, if you're a unit commander, to run your own initiative, you know what the objective is, and use your best judgment. He came up with that idea. It is the way how all modern war armies are organized. Most successful general in history.
I wasn't young, sir.
Only knows this all like the back of his hand. And this show had some really good history writers. They got that quote right. And most Americans quote this book, they think it's Blood and Iron. No, it's Iron and Blood. And an emphasis of that, I mentioned deviant art a moment ago, and I love the fact of how various deviant artists are taking various aspects of history, particularly artists in European countries or other countries, doing, here's our perspective on our own history as expressed through Natalia. Well, in reference to that same quote, here's one of my favorite little pieces.
I was a young man.
Huh? There we go. Okay. So that is, of course, Prussia, and the background text in it is the segment of that original quote in German. Nicht durch Reden oder Majoritätsbeschlüsse, sondern durch Eisen und Blut. I love being able to run panels where I can say that. So, the very first thing that, as you know, I'm sure you've seen the show, starts out with is itself a wonderful obscure history reference, which I will play for you now. But der Kongress des Tanzes, this was a real event where the Congress of Vienna, after the Wars of Napoleon, where the Austrian Prince Metternich, he was going to organize the peace of Europe, they got to this situation where all the representatives of all the great powers, all their princes and nobles, who didn't feel like spending their time in boring meetings discussing borders and things, they wanted to spend their time partying in Vienna, drinking and dancing and so forth. So this conference just went on and on and on as all the nobles and princes would spend their nights dancing and drinking, and nothing appeared to get done. However, this was a little bit deceptive. It was, in fact, stuff got done, but was getting done behind the scenes by the assistants and the staff members of all the princes and nobles. So the actual members of the Congress were buggering around, but their staff was doing all the work. Doesn't sound like my much has changed, does it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I love the fact that this, just that very first episode, it introduced people, Americans, to a bit of European history they probably didn't know. The next bit I show, just because I think it's one of the greatest visual metaphors I've ever seen. Okay, now some of the best jokes for history content in Italia, I find, are not the things like the Kongress Tanz, which was a bit of an exception, where they actually give you an explanation. I think some of the best and subtlest jokes in the show are things which they just sort of throw off as little comments and then go right by and don't give an explanation. Here's a perfect example. That actually happened.
Pasta made Germany's stomach worse.
Italian soldiers were using their water supply to boil pasta. Which is a real problem, not only because, you know, it's evaporating off, but the water that's left behind, you know, it's filled with pasta starch. You can't use it for anything else. You can't drink it. You can't even wash clothes with it. So, yeah, the Germans have to tell them, stop doing that! We're in the desert! So, yeah, and without giving you that explanation, you know, it's a silly joke in Italy. Pasta is crazy. But no, this is real shit. You know, the guy who wrote this show, you know, did some research and knows this stuff. But the next example I'm going to give, which requires a bit of explanation, is my favorite example of this in the show. And I think, literally, I'm totally serious, this may be the subtlest joke I have ever seen, not just in Italia, but in all of anime. Because the crux of this joke, the first time I saw it, you know, I read a fair amount of history, went right over my head, went over my friend Rob's head, he reads history for fun and has for years. You know, it was only because of seeing this show that it clicked to me what this joke referred to. But first, we'll explain the context. I will emulate the wailing of William I. What the hell is he talking about? Well, as it turns out, eventually, he's talking about not so much William I is the correct pronunciation in English, but the proper pronunciation would be Wilhelm I, the first Kaiser of the unified Germany. And the explanation is, as I said, came to me when watching this show, where episode 2 and 3 deals with the rise of Prussia and the unification of Germany. Because as it turns out, Wilhelm I, as first king of Prussia, and then later of unified Germany after 1871, was notorious for turning on the waterworks whenever he didn't get his way. Once I did some research on this, I did find some period newspaper articles which described Wilhelm I as the most histrionic monarch in Europe. Which further goes to show me that Hittikaz did some serious research on this and must be a fan of Prussia, because this is an incredibly obscure fact, which is very hard to find. So he must have read some serious deep books. But so examples of Wilhelm I. First, here he is. He's talking to his son, the Crown Prince, Prince Frederick Wilhelm, about the fact that he has a problem with the German Parliament, that he wants to extend the term of Elizabeth in the army, but the Parliament will vote on the funds, and needs to find a minister to act as a buffer between himself and Parliament. Okay, so the next time this happens, of course, the man they're thinking of is obviously Otto von Bismarck, and of course he gets Otto von Bismarck. And Bismarck is, of course...
I will be a screen between your majesty and your subject. Mein Parlament, Herr Bismarck. Perfectly simple, ignore them. Just spend the taxes. I would cut off your head. And mine. In the upper class, beneath my windows. I would have died fighting in the cause of my king. And you, in affirming your divine rights, what difference? Whether it's a scaffold or the battlefield.
I doubt if your colleagues would have...
As Minister President, I would have no colleagues, only subordinates. I would serve God through serving my king.
But there will still be a crown council. I shall wish Baron Slaughter to remain his
father. Well, I may as well! Don't threaten me, Father!
God said you'll do that!
I don't know what to do. Everyone is against me.
So now the next interest, remember that 1866 Austria-Prussia war? Well, the next scene takes place at the end of that war, wherein Prussia kicked ass and defeated Austria in the Battle of the Königgrätz. Because he's awesome. And because of, remember the thing I was telling you a moment ago about Moltke? This is because of, in large part because of that. The interesting thing that happened in that battle, and I'll also mention this, if I could organize the way history is taught in this country, I would love to teach a survey course on the role of racism in history. Now, there are the obvious things like slavery and the European Holocaust, but there are all kinds of subtle things, and stuff like this, because in that war, the Austrian forces were placed under the command of a Hungarian by the emperor. And most of the other Austrian top generals, who were, of course, Austrian noblemen, as most top generals in various countries were at the time, but I don't want to serve taking orders this Hungarian peasant. Yeah. So, in the key part of the battle, these Austrian forces are arrayed along a hill, and they seem to be winning, and one of the Austrian generals says, "We're winning! I'm not going to sit this here! I want to charge forward to get the glory! Go!" And he goes out and opens up a hole in his lines. At the same time, the Prussian forces are in partial disarray because one of the biggest Prussian divisions under Crown Prince Friedrich Wilhelm, the guy with the long bushy beard, is like, "Don't cry, Father," him, was a bit lost in the field. And his aides were saying, "Well, I think we ought to go north that way." He says, "But wait, I can hear guns. I hear explosions. I hear the battles over there." And a very famous quote said, "We will march to the sound of the guns." And they did. And they arrived at the battlefield, and guess where they showed up? Right in the middle of the hole that other guy opened up. And they rolled up the Austrian lines and won the battle with a fair minimum of loss on their side. So only because the Austrians like, "I'm not going to serve under some Hungarian peasant," they might not have won that battle. But racism lost in that war. This has happened over and over and over again in history. Examples of Russian generals who didn't want to serve under their commander and so, you know, messed up their tactics against Napoleon. This happens all the time. So Prussia defeats Austria. And the king, Wilhelm I, what he wants to do is, let's conquer all of Austria. Let's march the Prussian army down the streets of Vienna and take over the whole state. And Bismarck is like, no. They have all those Catholic Night Guards, Hungarians. We don't want them. We don't want a yard of Austrian land. All we want to show, like you say earlier, is that, you know, we're the 800-pound gorilla in Germany. Everything we want now, we can get with negotiation. Besides which, someday, I know we're going to have to fight our traditional enemy, France. And we don't want Austria hating us so much that they'll stab us in the back the next time we go to war. So Bismarck and all the other generals are like, no, let's hold off on this conquer Austria thing.
The army's not sick. God, let me be reasonable. With your majesty.
Now, as you point out, the reason why Wilhelm was so amazed that you agree with Bismarck is that usually Frederick Wilhelm and Bismarck were total loggerheads. Because, you know, Bismarck was much more authoritarian and conservative. Oh, God, I mean, we have conservatives like him in this country today. Frederick Wilhelm was much more the liberal reformer. He wanted to have a unified Germany, but have it organized more like England, have more of a constitutional monarchy, you know, have more liberal reforms and so forth, less emphasis on militarism and so forth. I consider it personally one of the great tragedies of history that he died so young. He basically after his father died, he was Kaiser for like a month before he died. Then we got his son, Wilhelm II, and we all know how well that went. World War I. Yeah. If I could do one thing, if you could go back in history and change, you know, people say, "Oh, I changed this battle," or something. Usually that would take a massive amount of stuff to fix. If I could do one thing, I would go back in time and put some really acrid, foul-smelling crap in Frederick Wilhelm's tobacco so he didn't start smoking, because he died of throat cancer. If you could stop this guy from smoking, we would not have had the stupid blunders and diplomacy that led us to World War I, which would not have led to the rise of the Soviet Union, the Communist Revolution. We would not have had World War I. The whole 20th century history would be different if this guy had not freaking smoked. And one of the reasons why he and his Rockefeller, like I said, he was, you know, a bit more, not a total pacifist, but was much more concerned about civilian casualties. And in the next big war, like I said, the war everybody was waiting for, is that was Prussia fighting France in 1871, the Franco-Prussian War, my personal favorite war of history, because it was the last time Germany got to beat France to dance with impunity. When they defeated the French forces in the field in the Battle of Sedan, then, you know, the French government was holed up, as it always does in Paris, and surrounded by Prussian troops who are waiting for them to surrender and are shelling, or want to shell the city. They're in a siege and they're waiting for France, for Paris to surrender. And if you know anything about sieges, for the people under siege, they are terrible. You know, pretty soon you can't get any supplies in and out, you run out of your food, and you start eating your dogs and cats. It gets really, really bad pretty soon. And Bismarck was impatient and said, well, let's start shelling the town. Start firing our wonderful Krupp artillery into Paris. And Frederick Wilhelm was like, no, I'm not going to shell civilians. That's just wrong. And they got into fights like this all the time. But despite that argument, the one thing they did agree on is, as Frederick Wilhelm said earlier, I will not be satisfied. His father did not want to be Kaiser. His father did not want to be, you know, Kaiser Wilhelm I, Emperor of Unified Germany. And most people think this is counterintuitive. You know, unify Germany. I'll have more stuff under my control, more power. But Dad's idea was, I was born to be the King of Prussia. I got that title from God. If we make up Germany, that's going to be men deciding to do that. So yeah, it's more land. It's still less of a fish. It's not ordained by God. But the Crown Prince, he wanted to have Germany united. And this is one thing that he and Bismarck were together on.
Yes. There is one matter of state in which we need each other.
Oh.
The unification of Germany. It is urgent that the German parliaments offer the imperial crown to my father.
You think it will be like in England? Democratic and constitutional? It will never be as I wish it. But your Royal Highness is not king yet. And the king will not accept it. Unless it's offered by the princess.
And he did. And he did. Okay, now to get back on topic, remember the original joke. Japan said, all you do if you're in front of a regiment of Englishmen, I'd emulate the wailing of William I. Now think for a minute about every time William I turned on the waterworks. He didn't want to have Otto von Bismarck because he's too violent, but he got Bismarck anyway. Bismarck, he wanted to have the Crown Council of Nobles to balance him out. Bismarck was with no one to start throwing furniture, so he didn't get that. The Emperor wants to conquer all of Austria and march the army down the streets of Vienna. Nope. I don't want to be Emperor, because I don't want to put down the Crown of Prussia for the Crown of Philip. Well, tough titties, we're going to make you Emperor anyway. Every time Wilhelm turned on the tears, he didn't get what he wants. So think about what Japan is saying. If I'm in this situation, I'm going to emulate the wailing of William I. Japan is saying exactly the same thing Italy said. I'm going to give up. I'm going to give in. I'm not going to get my way. But he's saying it in a way that obscures his true meaning, and in a way that if Germany still comes back and attacks and says, no, you need to fight on, you're a coward, Germany is attacking the memory of his own first emperor, thereby making himself lose faith. It'd be like America arguing that Washington was actually a pussy. So, Japan has obscured his true meaning and presented his argument in a way that if you come back at him, you lose faith. And that is so Japanese. That is the subtlest joke I've ever seen. It relies on this obscure knowledge, this obscure bit of history, and, you know, the way that, you know, the Japanese argue, the Japanese will never say no. They will, as it says in the anime, but they don't, you know, I'll think about it. You know, I'll consider all the options, you know, all of which mean no. This is the way the Japanese argue all the time. And when it dawned on me, when after seeing the show, when that clicked, I was just in awe. And the fact that this joke needed to be explained. So, I don't want to make this the all-Prussia panel, so something about Prussia.
Young Na?
Okay, so in this scene, England has watched too much Full Metal Alchemist. is trying to summon some sort of demon because he's been beaten up by Germany and figures, I'll use my bizarro magic powers to get back. And of course, he summons Russia. And when he gets rid of Russia, he has out you damn cold cuts. Another one of those little things where it's a comment just goes by and doesn't explain. Kolkhoz. What is a kolkhoz? A kolkhoz is the Soviet state collective farms. Under Stalin, during the Communist Revolution, Stalin was really worried about, I've got control of all the people in the cities. They're dense enough, I can have my spies and informants everywhere, and if anybody says anything I don't like, I can disappear them off to the gulag. But he went, all these peasants, Russia was a huge country with peasant farmers all over the place. He said, if they get annoyed, they could band together, and I wouldn't know what they're doing until it was too late. He was really worried about peasant uprisings and wealthy peasants, which he called kulaks, possibly subverting the revolution. So he had the Red Army go round them up and take them off their lands and send them to these collectivized farms and were told what to grow and how to grow it and so forth. Caused unbelievable hardships, routing up millions of people from their homes, sending them off to places they weren't familiar with. Caused mass starvation, millions of people. So horrible, monstrous situation. What England is saying here is, kolkhoz, it's a very nasty thing. But again, like I said, as far as deviant art, and let me hope that I can bring this picture up and not have a and use me die again. Came across when looking for stuff concerning this issue. Russia and Ukraine, and the Russian Cyrillic text in the back says, come and join the kolkhoz. Of course, most of the state collective farms were set up in Ukraine. So really, it was where some of the worst, most monstrous stuff happened. But nevertheless, again, fan deviant art, making use of these obscure bits of history to turn into artwork, and I just find that awesome. So, the next one of these silly offhand remarks about England from later in the
series.
Britannia whales curse the leek. There's something about leeks in anime. Okay, but the leek, what does the leek have to do with England and whales particularly? Well, as it turns out, the leek is the national, one of the national flowers of Wales. It's the leek and the daffodil, the symbols of Wales. This is supposedly, according to cultural lore, that some many centuries ago, the Welsh king Cadwallader, I believe, was fighting a battle against the Saxons, and in order to identify his troops, had all of his troops wear leeks. Yeah, it's difficult to pull off a decorative vegetable. This is the days before standardized uniforms and things. So how do I identify my own guys? Everybody's running around with people. All the guys who have this leek stuck to them, that's how I know who my troops are. So the leek is the national flower of Wales. One of the most famous references to this is from one of Shakespeare's plays, Henry V, where after the great Battle of Agincourt, where England defeated France, huge French army with almost no casualties, thanks to the terror weapon of the day, the Welsh longbowman. The king, who descends from the Welsh, is having a conversation with his aide-de-camp Llewellyn, who says that, oh, by the way, it's St. David's Day, which is the Welsh national holiday, and it's time to wear the leek. Very touching scene. Manly romance. And I have to admit, I have to give some props here.
The music.
Have any of you seen the history notes on the first DVD at all? A few of you. We wrote the text, but the Funimation people came up with the little titles for each chapter. And the title for the chapter where we wrote about this and the appearance of the leek, that Your Majesty takes no scorn to wear the leek upon St. David's Day. The title they came up with it is, His Majesty takes no scorn, but he will take a leek. I have to admit, it was difficult because when I got the email and said, here's what the titles are going to be, I was reading that when I was at work. I had very strongly suppressed laughing out loud in my cubicle at work, and everyone wondered what the hell was going on. So back to Russia. Yes, what this is referring to, Russia's curse. 1904, Japan was just beginning to be an industrial power. Remember, you know, Japan was, until about 60 years, thereabouts, you know, a totally isolated country. It had not really advanced in, you know, over 200 years since the battle of Sekigahara, the Tokugawa shogunate took over. And unfortunately, Japan was looking around and what's going on in Asia, and going, oh, look, England has pretty much taken over China, and France has taken over Southeast Asia and Vietnam. And if we want to avoid having us become a colony of some European power, we better get with this whole modern science and technology thing pronto. So Japan decided, all right, we're going to open up and industrialize, we're going to get the best of everything. We're going to have the English are the best at making navies and steam trains, so we're going to have them learn how to do that from them. The Germans have the best science education, we'll learn about that from them. The French have the best land army in Europe, so we'll learn how to organize the land army from them. Then 1871 happened, and Prussia defeated France in the Franco-Prussian War, and Japan said, oh, I think we'll organize our land army according to Prussia, thank you very much. But still Europe thought of, you know, Japan is okay, they're buying our trade and stuff, but there's still these little, again, racism, these little yellow monkey rice-eating people, you know, they can't. But if it came down to a real conflict with a real power, you know, they'd get beat. Well, 1904, there was a conflict over the Strait of Islands, Japan took over, which had been controlled by Russia. So Russia's like, well, we're not going to stand for this. We have the army, the navy is put together by Emperor Tsar Pete the Great. So, but the Russian navy didn't have it had lost its only port on in the Pacific. So they had to send the Russian navy all the way from, you know, their ports, you know, up past the North Sea, you know, past the Scandinavian countries, down past England, you know, around France, down, you know, past, you know, Africa, around the Horn, you know, up through the Indian Ocean, all the way around the world, thousands and thousands of miles, you know, months and months and months of travel to get the Russian navy up there. But this was okay because the Russian war minister said, well, we have a problem in Russia, that, you know, conditions are bad, people are starving, the peasants are revolting, in every meaning of the word. But what we need, if we have a short victorious war, it will stem the tide of rebellion and raise the sense of patriotism. So, yes, they didn't have a war with Japan, and it was short, and it was a victory. But it was not the victory that they expected. In the Battle of Tsushima, the navy of Tsar Peter the Great steams in, and Japan completely handed them their asses. Here's a trailer for a movie that brought to you by Toho, people who brought you Godzilla, about this battle. Now, the tactic in that battle, and why the Japanese won, was commanded by this guy, Admiral Togo Hayashiro, one of the greatest naval commanders in history. And so the Russians are coming north, and the Japanese are coming over, and the battleships, you know, they have guns on the front and the back, right? So it means the Russian ships coming up, only their guns at the front could shoot at the Japanese. But the Japanese coming across, this maneuver is called crossing the T, because that's, you know, the formation looks like a T. So then from the Japanese battleships, all their guns could turn and fire the Russians. So basically, if the Russians come up, blam, 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 blamity, blam, sink, well. And all of Europe was astounded. What? These little yellow monkey people beat them? Wait, what? Yeah, it's totally blue. And of course, Russia just worsens their situation terribly. And, you know, 10 years later or so, we had the Russian Revolution. So, and this has caused such a psychological blow to Russia that during the whole time, all the priests of the Russian Orthodox Church were having church services, you know, begging God to curse Russia or to curse Japan. Of course, nothing happened until 17 years later, 1923, the Great Kanto earthquake happened. You know, it's as bad as the Great San Francisco earthquake. You know, Kanto, the main plain where Tokyo resides, of course, all these wooden structures all collapsed. Tremendous destruction in Japan. It's like, ah, okay, our curse took 17 years for Japan to be struck by God. So that's why I say Russia's curse is in 17 years. So that's what that's talking about. So, oh, remember when I was talking earlier about, you know, Japan being isolated? So here's an example of that. Oops. Yeah, so remember what I was saying a moment ago with Japan? I'm considering it. This bit I love because there's like this one little segment could be like eight different subjects.
She won the French Revolution.
There's eight things you can talk about. Napoleonic Wars, the Hundred Years' War. And by the way, the Hundred Years' War, it's not like there was continuous battles for 100 years. You know, there were a lot of timeouts for, you know, let's have a crusade, let's have the Black Death, various sorts of things. So, yeah, it was not continuous battles, but yeah, Joan of Arc was an incident in that war. The Battle of Agincourt happened during the course of that sequence. A whole lot of stuff happened there. You know, Napoleon in there, but where it talks about France fishing in troubled waters, this is a little bit obscure. After the defeat of the Spanish Armada in England, sometime later, what they're talking about, we had to do a bit of research on this, what they're talking about is this. France, after Spain was weakened, sometime after the Battle of the Spanish Armada, sees that tiny little bit there, Roussillon, I may not be pronouncing that correctly, I'm German after all, from France, this tiny little bit of stuff just over the Pyrenees from Spain, and it remains a piece of France to this day. So, there you go. Now, there's another bit in there, which I want to talk about, where Prussia comes up and says, yo, Austria, whatever. We'll get to that in a minute. But that's referring to the outfit of Prussia, and going on to, now, they dealt with this a bit later in the World Series, the third season, and the War of the Austrian Succession. So, yeah, the War of Wall Street Succession. It's not just that Prussia said, queen is a woman now, so we're taking over. Before this, Austria was subject to something, a law known as the Salic Bar, which said that, you know, women cannot hold power. Women cannot be the rulers. This is also mentioned at the beginning of Henry V, where they're discussing whether or not certain areas of France belong to England or to France or not, and they cite this obscure law that, oh, no, it was the woman ruled this, and blah, 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 blah. And not only does it mean a woman can't hold power, but if you've got two lines to the throne where it's like either through the queen's kids or the king's brother's kids, you know, it'll go through the brother, because power, you know, should not pass to the woman either. Again, one of those sexist, racist, stupid things. Well, what if the king's brother's kids are all idiots? You know, is it? But nonetheless, so when the previous emperor of Austria knew that he was, you know, only had a daughter, he wrote up this document called the Pragmatic Sanction, and got all the other heads of the noble houses of Europe to sign it, basically saying, you know, my daughter is going to succeed me as empress, and you agree to sign onto it and accept it. So, of course, all the kings of Europe signed it, but of course, unless when she succeeded the throne, you know, Frederick the Great was like, Silesia, it has all this coal of natural resources, it's the precious, I want it. And so, you know, began the attack. And yeah, the Prussian army, Frederick was an absolute awesome, good military commander, organized his troops very well, you know, defeated Austria, and then, exactly as it says there, Maria Theresia went to the Hungarian parliament every day with her son, this is true, and said, yes, you know, please help us, please save Austria, and the Hungarians, you know, came through. Particularly Hungarian women can be scary, I can say this from a certain amount of personal experience, when they're out there. Empress Maria Theresia is also a fascinating character. She's most well known to history as the mother of a little lady named Marie Antoinette. This is not the first time she's shown up in anime, by the way. If you're interested in Marie Antoinette, another wonderful older and classic anime series, I highly recommend to you, The Rose of Versailles. Check it out. Here's Maria Theresia and The Rose of Versailles being worried about her daughter. Now, when Prussia declares war in that sequence, he has the first appearance in the anime of the little yellow Gilbert, as I believe it's come to be called. And it was a bit weird, okay, it's a little tiny bird, and he gets to go beep, 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 and kind of manly voice. And I have to admit, well, when working on this panel, putting all these clips together, you know, after a while, you start to go a little bit crazy, and so I made this. You can find that on my YouTube channel, and also the Friendship with Russia. Yes, those are all on my YouTube channel. So the antagonist in that war, Frederick the Great, as I mentioned. Wait. punches out a big
bird.
Particularly with the little flower there, which is actually called the hand of the maple. Alta, Kartoffel, what's he talking about? Well, Alta Fritz, old Fritz, is the nickname for Frederick. Kartoffel is the German word for potato. Yeah, we're talking about Frederick the Great. As I said, my favorite Enlightenment monarch. There he is. This guy did everything. Kartoffel, potato, is the German word for potato. He introduced the potato to Germany. Now, why did he do that? Because he thought potatoes were especially delicious? No. Because the way armies fought campaigns in that time period, they would have to march across territory to get where they're going, and they had no canned food or anything. So as they would march along, they would have to take food wherever they could find it. So local farmers would find their farms and their storehouses and their fields being raided all the time. And so even if you're not at war, you can find your country being devastated. But Frederick said, oh, these potatoes, they grow under the ground. And they supply almost all the nutrition you need. Just a little bit of additional vitamin A. You have some beans with them or some goat's milk or something. And a potato is perfectly good to supply your family, as the Irish figured out, which caused them problems later on. So Frederick said, hey, peasants, start growing potatoes. Because the army's going through, won't know where they're there. Or if they do, they're not going to stop long enough to dig up these little spuds. The problem is that people said, I don't want to eat this turd-looking thing. What is it? So the king, Frederick the Great himself, got a shovel, started digging in the ground, planted potatoes. When the king does it, you do it too. So it's because of Frederick the Great that the German introduced the potato. But as it shows here, this guy also wrote music. He played the flute. Here he is playing the flute at his court at Sanssouci, which is a little home away from home, his getaway palace, if you want to relax. Sanssouci, you'll note, is a French name. Most of the time, actually, Frederick spoke French, not German, because French was the language of the Enlightenment. And in Sanssouci, one of his best friends, and possibly more than that, hang out with his Voltaire, the famous French writer. German was sort of the language of the peasants, but like I said, he wrote music. He also studied botany. If you visit Sanssouci, and I think I have a picture here later on, he has a whole terraced garden with inlets for different kinds of plants to study potatoes and well-documented plants and flowers might help the German people. He introduced religious reforms. He gave freedom of conscience, or as we call it, freedom of religion. Didn't matter if you were Catholic or Protestant. That was cool. He introduced education for the general population. Like I said, brilliant military commander. Won almost every battle he fought, and when he didn't, he reorganized his troops very quickly. He was also very probably gay. And one of the first incidents in his life, when he was like 18 or 19, he ran away with this guy, Hans Hermann von Katte, his best friend, because his father was a complete utter bastard. His father was a real, you know, war is good for your health, and I will beat you until the morale improves kind of guy. And so he and Katte ran away, but were captured on the border and brought back. And since they were both officers in the army, this was desertion, technically treason. And so Dad was like, I'm going to teach my kid a lesson. So he imprisoned Frederick and had Katte taken out of the courtyard and had his head cut off in front of him. Now this would normally screw up most people, but Frederick seems to have gone all right. And in this scene here, this is an illustration where Katte is known to have said, Frederick is known to have said, Katte, my dear Katte, a thousand apologies. And Katte looks up at him and says, my prince, you have nothing to apologize for. Take this scene, draw bigger eyes, and put some sparkles on it. You've got a doujinshi right there. And the piece of music in the background, in fact, here is a flute sonata, which he composed. And a lot of people speculate that they made this a photo of Voltaire as well. In fact, when Voltaire went back to France, he wrote sort of a catty tell-all book, like The Secret Life of the King of Prussia. It's just like you'd have on the Lives of the Celebrities channel today. Education, music, military strategy, botany, just everything. And you still remember today. And like I said, brilliant military commander. That's leading the Prussian army. Napoleon, sometime later, after Frederick died, in 1800 or so, Napoleon, the French fought Austria, or fought Prussia, and won and defeated them at the Battle of Austerlitz. But Napoleon was a big fan of Frederick and studied his tactics. That's the facade of Sanssouci when I visited in 2002. And when Napoleon conquered Prussia and took his generals to the gravesite of Frederick, which is on the grounds of this palace, he made all his generals stand there and take off their hats. Because he said, men, if this guy was still alive, we wouldn't have won this war. That's how much Napoleon respected Frederick. The Sanssouci is actually a very small building. It's still nice to spend my time in a little bit. But it's only like 12 rooms. It was mainly his getaway when he didn't want to deal with the court. That's the interior of that facade that I showed you. We would hang out in the salon and discuss philosophy and music and whatever was gossip was going on in the French court. Another little anecdote I read about to show you this guy's personality. A traveler, there is the gravesite, Friedrich de Croisset, people leave flowers on it. I have a picture from DeviantArt of some German cosplay girls doing Frederick, and they said when they had gone there, they saw a Japanese girl in like a denim skirt, you know, putting the roses. They knew she was an Italian fan. She had a little Gilbert keychain on her backpack. You know, you've got tourists from all over the world coming and visiting this guy's gravesite because of this show. It's so awesome. This little anecdote. A traveler passing by Sanssouci in the late 1700s, you know, wandered under the grounds and saw an old man who assumed to be the gardener tending the flowers, and asked for directions and asked for to be shown around. And the gardener gave him a little tour, and he enjoyed it so much that when he was going to leave, he offered to give the gardener a tip. And the gardener said, "Oh, I'm sorry, but we can't accept. We, the royal we. Frederick the Great had just given this random passerby a tour of his own palace." This is the big monument to him in the center of Berlin, which has, of course, him on a horse. And remember some of these poses, because we have some fan art coming up, which represents some of these same things. Remember this picture. You'll see it again in a moment. Yes, this is a piece of DeviantArt where they took the exact picture and had inserted a Gilbert into it. One of my favorite things, but like I said, where people from all the country are taking, you know, I've seen Polish artists and Austrian artists and Swiss artists do bits of the history of their country. With, yeah, there's me on the ground of Sanssouci. Now, this is, when doing some research, I came across this bit of video, which is one of the best explanations of Frederick's tactics.
One of the greatest revolutionaries of all time. As king of the German state of Prussia in the 1740s, he led an attack on the powerful Austro-Hungarian Empire, capturing the province of Silesia. In 1757, Frederick defended his new territory. He marched his army 200 miles in 16 days to fight Austrian soldiers near the town of Leuthen on the Polish border. Outnumbered 2-1, Frederick used a tactic that became his hallmark. He marched the Prussian soldiers toward the Austrian front, then wheeled them to the right under the cover of low hills. They reappeared suddenly to the left of the Austrian army, which was being hammered by Prussian artillery. The Austrians were crushed.
By this music in the background, it's the Holy Friedberg March. Frederick wrote this too. I don't know exactly. He died fairly old. I think he was at least in his 70s.
The army he created was unmatched.
This bit is important.
Drill seems purely ceremonial, but men who could march precisely in time and change direction and speed as one on the parade ground could do so in battle. And on the 18th century battlefield, drill meant the difference between life and death. At Leuthen, Frederick and his troops changed direction while hidden from the Austrians. That reappeared where least expected. Yeah. The drill practiced by Frederick is still used today. Frederick's tactics at Boynton were a masterpiece of precise battlefield maneuvering, but they were achieved at a cost.
The tactics of 18th century gunpowder are required men to perform and drill in a very rigid and methodical way. In a sense, they had to be beaten into it. There's a famous phrase of Frederick's that the men are to more frightened of their officers than they are of the enemy. I think Frederick and the discipline walls various of their enemies. He moved to literally perform his army. Yeah, so at the time, remember, when you're running an army in the field at this time, you don't have things like radios. You can't tell people, oh, you guys over here go to this. You know, raise a flag or have a drum beat or so forth. You can tell the guys, oh, everybody, you know, start marching at this pace in this general direction, which is the only way you could get hundreds or thousands of guys, you know, to all move around in the direction of the same
opportunity to attack her arch rival, France. Britain joined the war on Prussia's side. A conflict that began in Europe now has spread worldwide. It would last 7 long years.
Okay, so I like this thing, these are our various deviant arts. The first couple ones were by an artist named Arnage, who seems to have a real thing for Frederick. And the first one was the first one I came across. The title of the first piece, where they're sort of looking along into each other's eyes, called August 17th, which is the date of Frederick's death. So it was, you know, sort of the commemoration of that. We have, you know, this artist said, yeah, why be Frederick? You'd be Frederick, be awesome! So, and the previous picture was Frederick with Voltaire. Remember that that statue in the center of Berlin? I think that's basically the same pose with little Prussia being on love. It's Prussia squish. Okay, this one I had to split into three pieces. This is also by Arnage. You know, Prussia looking weirded out, and Bishop the Great kissing his hand. But the important part is in the third piece. You probably can't read the text up the top, but it says, Ich bin der erste Diener meines Staates. I am the first servant of my state. And this was Frederick's credo. You know, not that as the king, you know, the state should serve me. My purpose as the king is to make the lives of my people better. That was his credo and his philosophy, and why I think he was, you know, such a great ruler. And, you know, so here he is, you know, serving, you know, Prussia in that sense. So I thought it was a particularly nice piece right there. Well, like I said, you know, for a long time, you know, before Hitalia came out, you know, I was interested in the history of Frederick, and the fact that this show has gotten more, you know, 15-year-old girls, you know, aware of this guy, like I said, I think he's old. So. This is another one of those little jokes that actually happened. When Japan sent its first embassy, its first ambassadors to the Imperial Court of China, you know, like 1,000 years ago or something, the ambassador, when presented to the emperor, said, I bring greetings from the Empire of the Rising Sun to the Empire of the Setting Sun. And the Emperor of China was so impressed he probably had his head cut off. It sort of soured Japanese-Chinese relations for quite a while. But yeah, it's, like I said, these little jokes that don't have any explanation that are based in real stuff are some of the best things in there. And here's another one. And unfortunately, this one a lot of people get wrong. And the fans of Pipeline's got this wrong. Everybody gets this wrong. I think Funimation got this wrong. I think that Tokyo Pop got this wrong when they published the first volume manga. It's not Pompeii's Pillar, P-O-M-P-E-I-I, which is the town that got its ass blown up by the volcano. No, it's Pompey's Pillar, P-O-M-P-E-Y, Pompey the Great, Gnaeus Pompeius Magnus, one of the greatest Roman generals who was defeated by Julius Caesar. If any of you study the Shakespeare play Julius Caesar in high school, you'll learn a bit about Pompey. Because, yeah, why would you have a pillar out of the Warrior's Code from this town that got blown up? I mean, just go, wow. But I can easily understand if you have, if you're writing this in Japanese, you probably have the katakana that probably say Pompeii, and if you don't know any better, it's like, well, what do I know? Pompeii has something to do with Italy. Oh, yeah, there was that town that got blown up. That's probably it. But no. It's this pillar, which may actually or may not have actually been dedicated to Pompey, but when in subsequent centuries, when travelers from Europe came across them, you know, they decided, oh, this has to do with Pompey the Great. Okay, yes, it's talking about Niccolo Machiavelli, who is most well known for writing The Prince. But a little bit of an interesting fact. If you ever want to impress a serious history professor, tell them this. The Prince, people read The Prince like it's the manual for how to be an evil bastard. And people think it's Machiavelli's advice on how to be an evil bastard. But actually, if you pay attention, Machiavelli wrote that when his town had been conquered by the Medici. And he was essentially writing this when he was in exile in another town. And instead of writing it in the language of the nobility, which of course was Latin, he wrote it in ordinary vernacular Italian. This was designed to be read by the regular people. This isn't a book, really, on how, for your noble, here's a manual on how to be an evil master. This is a manual intended for the ordinary people to say, look what sons of bitches those Medici are. You see, you have to be aware of the context. If you really want to know what Machiavelli thought about how politics should be organized, don't read the Prince. He has a series of books called The Discourses on Livy. Read that. And if you read that and have a history professor talk about this stuff, you will really impress them. Okay, it's perfect timing. We have Revolution War, America and England have shown up. But that's what we're talking about here. What England is talking about here, you know, damn you Lafayette, damn you Kosciuszko. What he's talking about are the foreign mercenaries that helped out Washington's army. Which goes to the famous French nobleman, the Marquis de Lafayette. Lafayette personally, out of his own personal fortune, paid for half of Washington's gunpowder for the Continental Army use. Thaddeus Kosciuszko was a Polish general who built the fortification walls around Saratoga, New York, which is very important because the first big battle that the Continental Army won against the British in Saratoga was the first battle where we had a European-style war. We had armies marching against big fixed fortifications. All the time before that, where we had won battles, it was basically what we would call guerrilla fighting today. Guys, snipers in trees, shooting the officers, which was very much no-no, you know, in Europe. And all the great European powers were saying, well, yeah, okay, they can, you know, take pot shots at officers from trees, but they haven't had a real battle with organized armies in the field, marching in nice, orderly ranks, and so forth. So until they have a real battle, we don't care. Well, Saratoga was a real battle, with armies fighting fixed fortifications, and because of Kosciuszko's fortifications, we won. And because of that battle, that the French said, oh, hey, maybe these Americans are worth supporting, and so here's all this money in this navy that we're not using. Here, you can borrow that. And, yeah, just have fun. Go kick England's ass. So, yeah, well, what England's going on about all the foreign mercenaries who helped Washington. And I think, unfortunately, in the dub, they sort of changed that and lost that bit of a reference there, which I think is one of the best examples of stuff about colonial history here, because the main thing about colonial history, they have this whole episode about America's shed cleaning. Right? Oh, we build up the three episodes. In America shed cleaning, we have the big reminiscence about the Revolutionary War. And there's nothing in it! You know, it's all America. Oh, here's these little toys, this blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay, I was gearing up. Okay, I can do history commentary on the Revolutionary War. And there's nothing to base it on in that whole episode. There's more content in this one joke than that whole thing. Okay, this is one where we had to do a little bit of research to understand what they were talking about. Protecting Burzenland from the Cumans. Yes, Burzenland was a piece of territory under the control of Hungary. And the Cumans, my friend Rob, like I said, who is a historian, had no idea what they were, but did a bit of research, and there were multiple names for the same tribe of people. They were also known as the Kipchaks. And the Kipchak Khanate knew about. They were related to the Mongol hordes, which were expanding. And yes, they were pushing the Kipchaks invading Burzenland. And basically what happened in this scene, in the background, you know, the King of Hungary asks the Teutonic Knights, you know, help us garrison Burzenland, because I want to go off, by the way, and take some of my nobles and go fight a crusade. So Teutonic Knights are like, yeah, sure, we'll do that. So the King of Hungary goes off on his crusade, but and the Teutonic Knights defeat the Kipchaks. But then decide, oh, now that we defeated the Kipchaks, this territory is ours. So we're going to impose taxes, and we're going to organize things the way we want, and so forth. So when the King of Hungary came back, all the local nobles were like, you have to get rid of these guys. They're doing our job. We're supposed to impose the taxes and all that stuff. So the king basically beat up the Teutonic Knights and threw them out. So the Teutonic Knights then did, in fact, migrate their way up toward Poland, where the king of Poland was having a bit of a problem with some barbarian invaders from Prussia, and said, hey, if you help us garrison Poland, and fight them, that would be really cool. But of course, having learned a bit, the head of the order of the Teutonic Knights said, okay, but before we do that, we want some guarantees that, we'll get to have this territory, we'll get to, have taxes or whatever we want to do. And the king was like, yeah, sure. So, which led to this little joke, where a Polish artist sort of explained the Polish view of Teutonic Knights Prussia. Because from the Poland's perspective, remember, Prussia is largely gone, and a lot of what was East Prussia is now Poland. So from the Polish view, there are a lot of these ruins of Teutonic Knights' castles around in Poland. And the Polish view is that, Gilbert, Prussia, is sort of hiding out in these ruined castles and kind of won't come down. So in this picture, it's like, here's the Teutonic Knights saying, this piece of territory, I built a castle here, so it's mine now. Mine. And Poland's going like, no way, man. And now we fight. And so at the modern day, Poland's going like, hey, come out of there, I want to tell your brother. And I'm like, no, I want to stay. So, this is, a bit of fair, which devolves exactly from, the stuff I was talking about a moment ago, about the Teutonic Knights did end up in Prussia. Or did end up in Poland. And I really have this problem with the heart is coming. And so the next piece here, this is another piece of DeviantArt. And again, this is one that taught me something. Again, I love it when fan art teaches me stuff I didn't know. This is a pastiche based on a painting, a real painting I'll show you in a moment, called the Prussian Homage. When some centuries later, the King of Poland decided to be a Protestant and said, okay, if the Teutonic Knights would follow the Protestant faith, I will make you no longer just a bunch of knights, but we'll make the head family, the head order of the Teutonic Knights, to be the Dukes of Brandenburg, which became the Hohenzollern dynasty, the kings of Prussia. As this is basically the beginning of the dynasty of Hohenzollerns, which later became Wilhelm I, and then the crown. In this picture we have, Prussia, of course, bowing to the King of Poland, and down at the bottom, modern-day Prussia, no way, that never happened. But, those were good times. This is the actual painting that the fan artist based it off of. Now, a couple of other things here, if you can get through them. Little Holy Roman Empire to bed, and for 1871, it's like, comes in, hey, West, guess what? I just beat France in the Franco-Prussian War. And it's like, oh, wait, what? And of course, he wakes up, and now we have adult Germany. To explain, by the way, what exactly it meant, unify Germany, I love showing this picture, because you don't understand what a complete mess Germany was. And why the rest of Europe treated it as if it had collective BO. You have France and Austria being organized, but Germany is this patchwork of states. Prussia and
really messy
down the bottom, and you have free states, and Brandenburg and Hamburg are free states, and there's this whole mess. And organizing this thing into one country was a difficult thing. For 1871, this happened.
100 years during the Holy Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm. He was dead for
that's where you want it to be, because you didn't have some monarch imposing legislation on you. You were relatively free.
Cute joke. Based on, because you see, Bismarck is often shown as having the pickle power, which is the Prussian helmet with the pointy spits on it. So this is one fan artist's take on why we have that. Pickle helmet, two feathers. Hey, I'm the older brother, and I'm 6 inches shorter. Well, okay, we'll fix that. Now this picture. Any of you fan artists? This is my personal quest. I want somebody to do this. I have lots of ideas for Italian fan art, but I have no artistic ability. This is one of my favorite paintings. This is Bismarck and Emperor Napoleon III after the decisive battle of Sedan in the Franco-Prussian War. Prussia has just defeated France. I want to see somebody do this picture, just like somebody did that Prussian homage picture, with Bismarck, you know, with Prussia dressed as Bismarck, and France dressed as Napoleon III, with Prussia going, I just kicked your ass, and you know, France going, kind of look. But that's exactly what's happening here. Napoleon III's outfit is basically the same as France's outfit. It's got the dark blue coat with the red poofy pants. You know, it's basically the France costume.
She asks if it could, she wants to know if it can be Shonen Eye or Yaoi.
It is France, yeah. No. That's the whole thing. Prussia's greatest joy, you know, just like Prussia's greatest joy is the national enemy of Germany is France. It's like it would be like England and France, Yaoi. It's I'm sure people can draw it. I have no doubt that people draw it, but still, from a historical perspective, it's like, no, I want to beat France up. I don't want to have sex with her. Here's another bit of a wonderful historical joke. Beethoven's Third Symphony, the Eroica Symphony, when he wrote it, at the time, he dedicated it to Napoleon. Because he had the French Revolution, he was very excited by the idea that, all these traditional nobles who were oppressing the people, we're going to get rid of them, we're going to have a republic and have democracy in France. And Napoleon's going to lead the republic. So here's, you know, young Napoleon going to France, I love that you got rid of your monarchy, I'm going to dedicate this to you. And France goes, well, you know what, in fact, I'm thinking of becoming an empire now, instead of becoming a republic. So poor young Beethoven is sort of crushed by this. It's like, my dreams are now crushed. They go and say, never mind. And since Beethoven was living in Austria, he goes back and says, all right, you're still cool. Yeah, of course I am. This one is a gag, which I particularly love. Okay. First, I'm sure this still picture, since the mascots of both America and Germany are eagles, it's like, okay, eagle land. We both have eagles together. But then, based on this one picture, there was this multi-part bit of fan art, which I thought was just one of the most hilarious things I've ever seen. It's like, okay, yeah, are we done with the previous picture now? Yeah, okay, so, but then everybody else goes, hey, I've got a white eagle. Poland has a white eagle. Yeah, Prussia, well, mine's black. It's bad.
We had shoulders.
Well, in fact, you know, Germans and Prussia, your eagle and my eagle are in fact the same eagle. And then all kids are, hey, yeah, are we talking about eagles? Because I got one too. You can switch the lions. Now, if the lions look away, we all have the same problem there. And Prussia is pecking.
Prussia has a two-headed eagle.
The Romanov two-headed eagle, and it's freaked out by that. So the best, here's the punchline, where he says, yeah, Europe sucks. And it goes, Ben Franklin, see? He took the country, as I wanted, and then it was in the city. Now, one other piece of...
That's another reason why they told me to awesome.
Yes.
Ben Franklin. Woo! Ben Franklin, thank you.
A turkey would be a really crappy mascot. Those things are dumb.
Yes. Yeah.
Dumb as bricks.
He can't wear them on his shoulder.
No, not very well.
He really dropped the ball on that one.
Yeah, I don't know if he interacted with turkeys.
But I think funnier than Napoleon III and Bismarck sitting there at the end of the Franco-Prussian War is that Kaiser Wilhelm was actually crowned in the Hall of Mirrors in Versailles, which must have been the most embarrassing thing.
I've been to the Hall of Mirrors.
Yeah!
Because I remember where I was showing that Frederick video earlier, they were talking about Prussian discipline, having all the troops organized, that Frederick organizing this way. What this joke is...
What did I just tell you about using your bayonet to roast marshmallows?
Bayonet is introducing these concepts. Washington's army, you know, was, you know, let's say, basically peasant farmers get together. We had no organization of having a professional army like we had in Europe. And it was kind of a ragtag mess. The way we got our army organized was a Prussian officer, Baron Friedrich von Steuben, who came over, who had been an adjutant to Frederick the Great, came over and trained our army, Valley Forge, you know, in Prussian discipline. And one of the things he found, in fact, was that the American army was using its bayonets, you know, to cook chickens or things like that over the fire. And so he would have, you know, Prussia going, no, I told you, do not use your bayonet that way. He trained the American troops how to use their bayonet, and in fact, the subsequent battle, when they ran out of gunpowder, they won the battle, you know, against the British strictly using their bayonets because of Steuben's training. Steuben's military manual became, you know, the military manual for the American army, you know, up through the early 1800s. When he was dismissed, he was given a big pension. He never married, and it was widely suspected, quite possibly, that Steuben may also have been gay. I will also point out, though, that one of the stereotypes, again, about Prussian discipline, people say, oh, sure, he imposed very strict discipline. In fact, he made the American army effective by relaxing discipline. Because Washington was doing you messed up, I'll beat you until morale improves. We have letters from Steuben back to his compatriots in Prussia saying, these Americans are kind of weird. In Europe, you give the troops the orders and you just tell them to do it, and they do it. In America, you have to explain to them why you're telling them to march this way or turn that way and so forth. But once you explain it, they'll do it. And so, by relaxing Washington's discipline and telling the troops why they're doing what they're doing, he actually made the army much more effective. So, there again, the thing I love about this show is, yes, it's silly and goofy and entirely too much Yowie for my taste, but, it's getting people, kids researching, Continental Army or European history or whatever. So, to bring the panel to a close, I will give you probably the single most important piece of information you will take away from this. One of these.
It is a glass booth.
Some of you may be in college or perhaps will be soon, and this is an important drinking game. The way to use one of these, you fill it with beer and have a bunch of people pass around, and everybody takes a drink from it with the toe pointing up, right? And as the beer gets lower and lower, eventually, the air pressure holds the liquid in the toe until eventually it gets level enough where the tension breaks and the air bubble pops into the toe. And whoever's drinking from the boot, when the air bubble bloops, they buy the next round. That's, knowing is half the battle, and now you know. So there it is. So thanks for coming.
I thought shooting the boot was grosser than that. I thought rugby players drank out of actual boots.
Oh, well, I'm sure that the meaning has changed over time.
Yes.
No, it's probably the same.
America, my God, let me see.